Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Marcia Joyner, your host with Betrayed by Hospice. A shout out to Marty for giving us a forum to talk about topics that many do not know and others do not want you to know. They're not pleasant topics, but they may one day save your life. This talk show was created to bring awareness to people who might not otherwise know about the dangers of enrolling their loved ones or themselves into hospice without knowing the facts and the risk. Hospice was originally created to alleviate physical pain for the terminally ill who were actively dying from a disease that couldn't be cured. Today, the criteria for being enrolled has been watered down so that treatable illnesses and dementia qualify, as well as something as simple as being incontinent or not being able to feed or dress yourself. Hospice calls it comfort care, which often involves sedating patients to unconsciousness to prevent them from feeling the pain of the thirst and hunger that they create, and then they die from the drugs and the dehydration, not from any illness, and certainly not fear or pain-free. There is nothing comfortable about this type of dying. And yet the elderly and disabled people are being targeted daily as being not viable to society and thus are expendable. The recent case in point is COVID patients being sent to nursing homes. The reality is sad, and if you haven't experienced this personally, you may have no idea why we are so outraged and we're fighting so hard to educate and warn others of this danger. Previous shows go into more detail about the drugs and why it has become a lucrative business and it isn't about compassion for others. You can listen to those shows at your leisure at the same link at this show. Just look for Betrayed by Hospice. I'd like to give you some websites that are useful, and I encourage you to visit. They are hospicepatients.org and halovoice.org. Recently, Halo Voice set up a helpline that you can contact for advice. That number, 817-995-1139. If you are already aware of the dangers of hospice and you would like to volunteer to become an advocate, please contact them. They're always looking for help. You can also find information on setting up a medical power of attorney or opt out of organ donation. Another useful link, if you're in trouble and your loved one is in a facility and you're trying to get them out or trying to get them help, is Life Legal Defense Foundation, which can provide information on lawyers that are pro-life in most states. Please take advantage of these links. Contact me at marciajoyner2018@gmail.com if you have questions, you want more information, you want me to give you the links, or you have a story you would like to share. Tonight, our guest, Lisa Papania from Ohio, will share with us the story about her dad, Bill Papania's story of his hastened death on August the 13th, 2015, at the young age of 67. It's important for you to know that Lisa was very close to her dad and that she met with him, with her boyfriend, every Sunday at church, so she is aware of his day-to-day living situation. She had a suspicion of what was happening and knew it was horribly wrong, and she tried to intercede to save her dad, and she'll tell us what happened and how she lost the battle. Phil had recently retired and was not actively dying when he was medically kidnapped and placed in hospice against his knowledge and against his will. He was drugged with morphine, Ativan, and Haldol and strapped to a chair at a nurse's station where he was treated inhumanely. There are so many facets to this story that you may identify with some of them. So with that, I'd like to introduce Lisa to our listeners. Lisa, again, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I appreciate you agreeing to come on tonight and share your story with us. I know it was tough on you, and you're still struggling, and you're still fighting this battle. And as we've talked about many times, we never give up. So would you walk us through what happened to your dad? Lisa, can you unmute us? Lisa? Lisa, Marty, do I still have you on? Okay. I'll start, and hopefully Lisa will join us. In 2012, Lisa's mom, Carol, had taken him to three different neurological doctors to have him declared incompetent. At this time, he was around 63 or 64, and he wanted to keep the peace. He wasn't incompetent, but he had very mild dementia, a little bit of memory loss. He was driving himself to work, taking care of the bills, doing daily activities, and he retired at the age of 65 in 2013. In early 2014, he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, and he was given chemo by pill, but the cancer went into remission. Later that same year, in 2014, Carol had been in the hospital for Crohn's disease, which required surgery. She went to the rehab facility for 3 weeks for recovery. One day, Bill, her husband, came in and brought her a chocolate cake, and she started screaming at him, "I don't want you here." And so they asked him to leave. Now, the reason that Lisa will bring this up is it turns out it's the same facility that Bill will go to later on that will be the end of his life. Lisa, are you with us yet? Okay. All right. I'm not sure if anybody's hearing me. After she had been in the hospital in that same year, in May of 2014, Lisa received a call. Well, let me go back. Her dad, they had determined that he had esophageal cancer and it had gone into remission. Then Lisa got a call from a doctor's office saying that her dad had not been coming in to his appointments to have Coumadin for a thinning of his blood. Lisa wasn't aware that he had missed any appointments until he called her. So her dad said, when she called him, said, "I'm not aware of missing any appointments." And her mom overheard the conversation, got on the line, and wanted to know why Lisa was talking to her dad, and pretty much told her it wasn't any of her business. So, Lisa, if you're on, can you unmute your phone? Marty, she's telling me that she is on the call. But we
Hello?
Can't hear her.
On here.
Okay,
there you go.
Lisa,
there
I can
you
hear
go.
You
I got
now.
Her.
Can you
okay.
hear me now?
Oh,
we
good.
Can hear you.
Okay.
I've been talking with Marcia.
It will be like the Brady Bunch, right?
Okay, yes.
So where we are is when you received a call from the doctor's office stating that your dad had not been coming in to his appointments. And I'm sorry for the
right.
listeners because Lisa can tell you a much better story. Okay, so hit it, Lisa.
Well, what happened is I received a phone call from Susie at the doctor's office, and she's kind of angry at me. And she said, "Lisa, if your father does not make it to his next appointment, he's missed two or three appointments so far, Dr. Lunenberg is going to take him off of his Coumadin because he's missing his PTINR appointments. And I was like, that doesn't sound like my father. And she was, well, he has. And you need to get a hold of him and let me know what's going on. So after I hung up the phone with her, and this is towards the evening, I hung up the phone with her and I immediately called my father. And I called him on his cell phone because that's how we mostly communicated. And I said, Dad, what's going on? He goes, what do you mean what's going on? I said, why are you missing your blood center appointments for your Coumadin? I'm not missing my appointment. Your mom's in charge of that. She lets me know when my next appointment is. I said, well, has she told you? No, she hasn't told me about any appointments lately. I said, they've called me, and they said you've missed appointments. And he goes, Carol, like that. And he goes, why am I missing doctor's appointments? You're in charge of that. You have it. What's going on? And at that point, she grabbed the phone from him, and in her, you know, angry voice, she told me that this is none of my business and hung up on me. And at the time, I was at my boyfriend's house at that time when I got the call, and we both just looked at each other like, oh, God, here it comes. So I wanted to call back there, but the office was already closed for the evening, and I had to wait until the next day to call back. And when I called back the next day, I did it during a lunch break. I think it was around between 1 and 2. And I called and I spoke to Susan. I said, Father. And she goes, Lisa, I'm sorry. I can't talk to you. And she acted funny. And I'm like, well, what do you mean you can't talk to me? You just called me yesterday. I checked with my father. He said he's not getting the appointment. He said he didn't have an appointment. My mom's in charge. She goes, Lisa, your mother was just here. And she's removed you off the HIPAA list. And I said, what? It shocked me. Not shocked me, but I just didn't think she could do that. And I've been on his HIPAA list. I've been a contact. And she goes, I'm sorry, I can't speak to you about anything. Your mother was here, and she removed you off the HIPAA list. And I was like, but Susie, my dad does not want me. He wouldn't want me removed. And, well, your mother removed you. I can't talk to you. And I was still just at a loss. So I called my father. And he answered, of course, and I said, Dad, what's going on? He goes, what are you talking about? I said, Susie said you removed me from, Mom removed me from your HIPAA list. What are you talking about, Lisa? And I said, Mom removed me from your HIPAA list, and I cannot know any information about your appointment. Like yesterday, about you missing appointments, they couldn't get a hold of Mom, so what they do is they call me. Well, Lisa, I never removed you from my HIPAA list, and I don't know how your mother could remove you from my HIPAA list. And of course, she was sleeping at that time because she must have gone early, and then by the time I was able to get a hold of him and question him, she had gone back to bed. Her sleep pattern is not normal like everyday people. She usually goes to bed between 6:30, 7 a.m. in the morning, and she's in bed till at least 7 or 8 p.m. at night. And then she gets up and she's up all night. So, and I couldn't question her on this. And he wasn't even made aware that I was removed off the HIPAA list. So, kind of put that on the back burner for a day or so to go from there. And, I was concerned about him missing those appointments. And can you hear me, Marcia?
I can hear you, yes.
Oh, good, good. Mm-hmm. So that right there, that was a red flag. And just went downhill from there. My father, my father had mild memory loss. And he was diagnosed with mild dementia, mild memory loss, I would say around the end of 2000, early 2012. And at that time, my mother and I were still talking. In fact, I drove them to some of the doctor's appointments, and I was very active in their lives. My mother, like I said, she has Crohn's disease. She has times where she does have great amounts of pain and cannot leave the house. But I was going to these doctor appointments with her. I remember one was in Mount Healthy. That was the first. No, the one that was first was a doctor near in Cheviot. I've grown to hate that word. But we went to a doctor in Cheviot, and he tested my father, and he had conversations with my mother and me, and he brought us in for a visit and just proceeded to tell my mother, and he was kind of angry about it, and I didn't understand why this guy was so angry, but come to find out down the later on, my father said that she and the doctor had gotten into an argument, and she insisted that this doctor declare my father incompetent. And the doctor said, I'm not going to do no such thing. I suggest you deal with this. It's mild memory loss at this point right now. And I've tested him, and I'm not going to declare him incompetent. And that was the end of that doctor. So then she found another doctor, and this doctor was in Mount Healthy. And we went to this one, and my father, being the nice guy he is, more or less just went along with it because he and I knew you're not going to be able to get him declared incompetent. He's not incompetent. And went to a couple visits for that, and the guy had the same diagnosis. And actually the same second doctor had spoken to the first doctor, and he had the same answer for my mother too. He's not incompetent. I'm not going to do that. He's a very nice gentleman. He's very alert. He's answering all of my questions. He has just maybe, he has, you know, he's forgetful on some things. He goes, but I'm not having any issues and I'm not going to do it. And at that point, it became all about her. She did her act. She did her crying, you know, trying to get sympathy for herself. And the doctor suggested to her, he said, look, you're going to need counseling. You need to go. There's support groups out there. And she's just, it's all about her. What am I going to do? I don't need this. I'm not taking care of him. I'm not doing this. And it's just bizarre. So because that doctor didn't declare him incompetent, she found a third one. And the third one I really liked. His name is Dr. Hughes. And he actually was closer to home. This one, and same thing, you know, refused to declare my father incompetent. I went with them to the visits, and come to find out, going through the medical records from his office, because after my father's death, I retained administrator of his estate and was able to get all the paperwork from all of the doctors. She had been calling Dr. Hughes' office pretty frequently, demanding him to declare my father incompetent. She made some of the most outlandish stories to him. She said that my father pushed me, not her, but he had pushed my daughter, and she had bruising all up and down her arm. That was a total lie. Never happened. She was making up instances of herself, saying that she was being hurt, that he was pushing her. He was screaming at her, and it couldn't be further from the truth. And the only reason I knew this is because I saw the records that the MA was taking from her. And at one point, my mother had gone, they had gone for a visit, and Dr. Hughes is a neurological doctor. And Dr. Hughes, when he refused to sign off on any paperwork to declare my father incompetent, she proceeded to scream at him in his waiting area in front of people in the waiting area. And it took him to threaten her that he will call the police and order her to leave. And my father, as usual, just embarrassed and tried to guide her out of there and get her out of there.
Now, let me stop you at this point. During this time, your dad is still working
a full-time job, driving himself to work, and very responsible. So, and I think we'd say all of us have a little bit of memory loss. So these were all things that your mom was trying to get him declared incompetent so that he could go somewhere so she just didn't have to deal with him. But
exactly. And Marcia, it got so bizarre. She and I, God is my witness, she did this. She proceeded to go to the bank. And, you know, I would tag along because I would just, you know, play, you know, not involved, taking a side. I went for my own sake to be in on these to see how far she was going on this. And I don't think I had told you about this, but one time she tried to get him off of all the accounts, checking accounts. She wanted his debit card taken away, and she wanted, I swear to you, this is how bizarre it was. She brought the air, you know how your air conditioning vents, you put in a new filter at least once a month?
Yes.
She brought one of those filters with us to show the bank manager that he's forgetting things and he's becoming incompetent, and one of the filters had not been changed in over a month, and that was her proof that he was incompetent.
Oh my gosh.
My mother. Hmm. And the bank manager was just like, you know, everybody has the same expression. So when she herself never told me about Dr. Hughes. I found out I knew going in there with Dr. Hughes. He tested my father. He and my father really enjoyed each other. They would laugh. They had, you know, get along. Of course, she didn't care for that because she knew then, you know, her chances of getting a doctor to declare him incompetent were more slim to none. And it wasn't working. So I found out about her being asked to leave, and if she wouldn't leave, they were going to call the police through talking to the MA and through the records. And during this time, after Dr. Hughes, she found Dr. Kassav, and that's when the nightmare started.
Mm-hmm. Early 2015, when you started noticing that your dad's voice was starting to sound a little raspy again?
Yes. Well, no, and actually, well, that started in 2014 when his voice started sounding raspy, and I was okay. Me and my mother were okay at this point. This is in 2014 where, you know, his voice was getting, you know, raspy, and I told her, I said, he's got to get checked. So that was all around the time with Dr. Lunenberg and all that. And, you know, she was on board for him to get treatment and stuff. And there was numerous times when I actually went with him. I met them up at Mercy Hospital. I would come up right after work when he was getting treatments, and she would leave so that she could go back home to bed because, God forbid, you disturb her sleep. And I would be one to take my father home. And he was being treated. He went into remission. End of 2014, though, she and I had a fallout, and I just couldn't deal with her anymore. And beginning of 2015, I would say maybe January, February, early January, his voice was getting raspy. And my father has two siblings that are still alive, an older sister and brother. And that's my Uncle Larry and my Aunt Carolyn. And my Uncle Larry lives in New Orleans. My Aunt Carolyn lives in Mississippi. My Aunt Carolyn and I, at one point, used to be close. We would talk and stuff and mostly talk about my father. And my Aunt Carolyn and I both would talk on three-way calls to my Uncle Larry. And my Uncle Larry, being a former priest, pretty much he can get along with anybody. And mm-hmm. he can tolerate behavior of other people, you know, outrageous behavior. And my mother had a rocky past with my father's family. She did not like them. And he had two other siblings that had both passed away years before. And she didn't like any of his siblings. And my Aunt Carolyn and I talked to my Uncle Larry. My Uncle Larry said he'd take one for the team, and he would talk to Carol and discuss about my father needing to go to the doctor to get checked because we had suspicion that the esophageal cancer was back. He was in remission, and we had suspicion that it was back because of his voice. And I would talk, when I see my father at church or when I would talk to him daily, or me and John, we're taking turns to come over every day to see him while she's sleeping, bring over food to him and stuff. He would say, Dad, you got to get to the doctor. Your voice is, you know, no, Lisa, I'm fine. I just got a cold. It's dragging. I said, no, Dad, you need to go to the doctor. Well, of course he wasn't going to, and made attempts to talk to her. She refused to talk to me. And my Uncle Larry did call. He was able to speak with her, and he was able to arrange for my mother, my father, and their grandson to go with them to the doctor's office, get my father checked out. And in fact, my uncle, he made the appointment because he was aware of the doctors. He was on the HIPAA list. I was off the HIPAA list, but my their grandson and my uncle were still on my father's HIPAA list. So come to find out, testing came back that he did have esophageal cancer again. And this is early 2015, and he was going to his appointments, or at least I was told he was going to his appointments. She had me blocked from getting any information from Kassab's office. Lunenburg's office would not talk to me about his blood doctor, wouldn't give me any information. My uncle would make calls. My mother said, yes, he's going to his appointments. My father would tell my uncle, yes, I'm going to the appointments. But my dad was getting so skinny. This time it was totally different. It's like the first time he had cancer, he looked the picture of health. I mean, you couldn't tell. You know, he had weight on him. In fact, there's a picture that I posted on Facebook. And, you know, when you retire, you tend to put on a little weight. My dad had been so skinny all his life. And for the first time ever after he retired, he had a belly, a little belly, not big, but just a little belly. And
right.
When he had cancer the first time, he still had that belly. But the second time, he just scarecrow skinny. It was awful. And that's when my boyfriend and I were going over there bringing chocolate. My dad loves chocolate, brought him chocolate shakes. We would, you know, John would talk to my mother, and we'd go to Sam's Club, and we would get Ensures for him. You know how you can buy them by the case?
Right.
And
right.
She would allow that. And one time, though, she found out about us bringing the chocolate shakes. And this was during the daytime, and we were in the driveway, and we were sitting out there talking with my dad because, you know, everything's safe while she's sleeping. And he had a UDF milk chocolate shake in his hand and was sipping on it, and she just went off. And she called the cops on us. And this was common behavior with my mother. She would call the police like it was just a normal thing and tell them some outrageous lies. Police would show up, and they knew going to that house because they keep a history of, you know, how many calls they've been there, and it was just normal. And it got, sometimes the cops would tell her, one more false call, one more call, Carol, one more, and, you know, she played victim and all that good stuff and lie, but I would usually wait around till the cops got there, explain to them she's not there mentally. My father is got mild dementia, but, you know, he's alert and he's everything still, just a little memory loss, but he's going through cancer. She's not treating him right. And we were bringing over a milkshake, and she goes off, and they said, okay, well, we'll deal with her. And we left. And this was in May. And I don't know if I had told you this, Marcia, but one time towards the end of May, we were at church on a Sunday, and he was just so skinny. His eyes looked so hollow. And you know, my uncle, my aunt, and I, we could only get so much information from him. And according to him, everything's going finely. So I'm going to church. I mean, I'm going to my treatments. Your mother's telling me when all my appointments are. I said, well, Dad, get me back on your HIPAA list. Okay, well, I'll call there. And they would never put me back on the HIPAA list. I don't know what my mother said to the doctor's office, but even with my father saying that to put my daughter back on the HIPAA list, they would not put me back on. And at church, I was so concerned about him. And, you know, we sat through Mass. We got outside. We were walking towards his car, and I looked at John, and John purposely went to go get his truck to pull up next to my dad's car. And I was telling my dad, I said, Dad, you're looking too skinny. I said, and I told him, I started crying, and I said to him, I said, Dad, she's going to kill you. She's trying to kill you. You're looking too unhealthy. If you're going to for your treatments and stuff, you shouldn't look like you're a walking skeleton. He had bags under his eyes, and I was crying. John had pulled up at that time. My dad wasn't crying, but he had tears in his eyes. He's like, Lisa, I've got it under control. Don't worry about me. Everything's fine. I've got this under control with her. She's not going to kill me. She's not going to have me killed. I'm not going to die. Everything's going to be fine. I said, Dad, you want to fight this, right? And he's like, yes, I want to fight this. I'm going to fight this. I'm going to live. And we left, and he left, and we, you know, usually we'd follow him. I lived two streets over from them, so we'd follow him to the bottom of his street and go back home to my house.
He just wanted to keep the peace.
Yes.
With your mom.
His whole life, that was his whole life. Keep her happy. Let her think she's calling the shots. It wasn't just with me.
Well,
it
she was.
With everybody. She was.
She
but
was.
But you know what, though?
Yeah.
The thing is this. She was not able to call the shots like she did or control him or manipulate him like with the doctor's appointments until the esophageal cancer happened. It's kind of like she was able to pounce and get more control over everything. He had told me she had kept her, she would not give him his debit card. I told him, I said, you just need to go off to the bank and get a new one, Dad. You do not have to have her control you like that. He says, Lisa, she's got a code word at the bank now. I mean, it was just getting more bizarre. And then also I noticed he was just becoming more, he wouldn't fight back. He was becoming more feeble towards her.
Right. Well,
and allowing her to take control.
Yeah,
yes.
Just to go along with everything. So on June the 7th, he doesn't show up at church.
Correct, and that concerned me. And like I said, me and my father, our communication, and John would even, he had my father's cell phone. We would call, our communication was through the cell phone because you call the house phone, that wakes her up, and that proceeds to have her go off, and it's just easy to call the cell phone. He didn't show up at church that night. It was a 7 o'clock Mass. He wasn't there. I called after church. I called probably till 10 or 11 that night. No answer. Monday, went to work, and John and I both took turns calling all day long. We even attempted to call the house phone. No answer. She had been known for taking his cell phone at times, so didn't know if that was one of those instances. I had no clue, though, what was about to be found out. But by Tuesday of calling him, speaking back and forth with my aunt and uncle because they couldn't get a hold of him. We're all worried. I called Green Township Police to do a welfare check. And I can remember this like it was yesterday. It was on a Tuesday evening, say about 7, 8 p.m. at night. And they went over there. They first stopped at my house. I gave them the information. I let them have a little history on her. And they went over there and shortly after came back to my house. And like I said, I live two streets over. Came back to my house. And this is a real nice cop. He was so talkative. And he was like, he kind of looked weird. He was like, well, we went over there. He goes, a good while for us to pound on the door. He goes, it got to the point where I called my commander-in-chief, or I forget what he called him, and nobody was answering the door, and I guess that was their next thing that they called their chief, because usually what they do is they break down the door.
Right.
And after a while of pounding on the door, she comes to the door, and her first response, no, hi, how are you? What are you here for? What's going on? First thing she says to the cops, what, did my whore of a daughter call you? And, of course,
wow.
That kind of took them aback. And they talked to her. She said, you know, she told them, I took them to the hospital early this morning. Don't tell my daughter. She's not to know where he's at, and which hospital or anything like that. And they came back. They told me what she had told them. And she wouldn't let them know which hospital it was, because they couldn't tell me what hospital it was. I know
but
that
my
father.
She had taken him there, like, really late Sunday night, early Monday morning, right?
No, that was actually, it was actually, okay. Sunday was June 7th, June 8th. Something must have been going on where he was not feeling well. His belly was hurting. Stomach was hurting. It was late Monday night, early Tuesday morning. No, it's late. Let me think here, Marsha. I'm so sorry. I have the timeline. Because he was dropped off on the 9th. And the 9th was Tuesday, correct?
Okay.
Yes.
Ninth was Tuesday. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So on late Monday night, early Tuesday morning, she physically dropped him off at the ER and left. But she called back there and told them that no family is to talk to him, nobody is to get any information on him, and only she is. And at that point, she didn't say just me. It was the whole family. Nobody could have any information on him. And I put two and two together, because the cops had no idea which hospital it was, because she wouldn't tell them. But the doctors my father was seeing for his hematologist and primary care physician, Dr. Kasav, are with the Mercy Network. So I called Mercy Hospital many times on Tuesday, and the operator wouldn't give me any information, but I could kind of tell that he was there, because she goes, I'm not authorized to give any information concerning him. So right there I knew he's there at the hospital, okay? And it was, per the wife, we're not allowed to give any information. So I knew he was there. I said, well, I'm coming up there to see my father. And she says, well, we're not going to tell you what room he's in or anything like that. I called several other times, and it's like they must have the same operator that handles their switchboard. I have no idea. It's an older lady. But I got pretty frantic about it, because, you know, you've got a parent that's possibly there. You don't know if the parent's alive or dead,
right,
or what's going on. So I was crying. I was frantic. And she told me, my suggestion to you is to call the next day and talk to social services, call them early. I said, how early? What time do they get there? She says they're there at 7 a.m. So didn't sleep a wink, had to go to work that day, but I was going to call there, and I called there at probably 6:58, 6:59. And I talked to a social worker, very nice woman, was very compassionate. And I said, look, and she said she couldn't give me any information. I said, look, I need to know this much at least. And I am his daughter. I am his blood. I tried to explain to her, my mother's mentally ill. She has issues. She hates my father. She hates me. She's not dealing with the full deck. What is going on? I need to know if he's alive or if he's in the morgue. At least let me know if my father's alive. And she goes, honey, all I can say is this. He's not in the morgue. Okay. So that told me he was still alive.
Right. And where he was.
Exactly. And she wouldn't tell me the room. And I told her, I'm coming up there. She goes, you can't. They're not going to give out the room number. We have strict orders from the wife to not let anyone speak to him or tell the room number. And I said, you know, you're dealing with a crazy woman, I was telling them. You know, I sound like a broken record, but I mean, how many times can you tell people that the wife is crazy? So that's Wednesday. You know, tried several times to get through to them. I called my aunt and uncle. And at that point, I noticed my aunt and uncle were acting funny. And mind you, my aunt lives in Mississippi. She herself was dealing with cancer herself. She had been a smoker all her life, and she was dealing with cancer. Unfortunately, it's so crazy, but my uncle in New Orleans, his wife was dying of cancer. So, and he had hospice going on at home. He was taking care of her. He was administrating any of her pain medication, all that good stuff. Neither of them could come into town because of their own situation. 2015 was just the best horrible year. And and our normal, me and my aunt would text each other, and she wouldn't respond back to me, and I knew that was something was off. And then I would call my uncle. He wasn't answering his phone. And come to find out, my uncle had spoken to my mother, and he had gotten it out of her that, yes, Bill was in the hospital. She had dropped him off. He had stomach pains. But if they were to tell me where my father was or anything going on, she would make sure that they never spoke to their brother ever again. I mean, can you even imagine?
No, I can't.
So that's how much control she had.
After, I think you called APS, right?
I had called APS in the meantime and let them know. And they were, you know, their whole thing is if a person's alone by themselves and do they have money, that kind of thing. Is anybody a threat to their well-being or what kind of cash? I mean, it's just, I found APS to be a very different side. They didn't have any concern. Police couldn't do anything because the police will refer you to call APS. APS, they would contact her to see what's going on and do their own thing.
But by them contacting her, she wound up, after they called her, didn't she wound up then deciding you could come see him?
No,
she doesn't want to look bad to them, right?
Well, the thing is this. I don't know if she even picked up the phone with them or what, because, you know, she has a history of not answering the phone. But now, this is Wednesday when I was trying to get information, found out from my uncle that my mother, he knew where my father was, but if he had said anything, that they were both told they would never, ever speak to my father again. So he said, Lisa, she put us in that position. That's our brother. We love him. Of course, we're going to let you know what's going on. But right now, we don't know what's going on, but we know where he's at. So that's on Wednesday. Thursday, while I'm at work and while John's at work, about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, between 4 and 4:30, John gets a call. And it's my mother from her cell phone, and she – just real dryly said, you know, very just monotone voice, you can tell Lisa I've lifted the ban, and his friends and anyone that wants to call him or see him can go up there now. And he said, what room is he in? And she gave him the room number and just hung up. That was it. Didn't give anything else, just was very blunt, kind of weird. Just a monotone voice, didn't give any other information. She just said, you can tell Lisa she can see her father now. I've lifted the ban. People can see him. So I left work early, and John and I ran to Mercy Hospital. He met me there at the hospital. We went to the room, and there's my father sitting up in the bed smiling, you know, hey, Lisa, and, you know, just happy to see me and John. Hey, John, and, you know, happy everything. I said, Dad, you don't know what I've been through for the past few days. Why haven't you called me? Where have you been? He goes, I don't have my cell phone, Lisa. And he goes, my cell phone's missing. And I knew what was going on. She kept it from him. He told me how he was having some stomach pains, but he felt better. And early Tuesday morning, she dropped him off at the ER and said she was going home back to bed. I said, nobody thought to call me, nothing. And he's like, I gave them your number. I told them to call you. He goes, He goes, they were calling her, not getting through to her, so they had your number. He goes, but they never called you. I said, no, Dad, I had to go through hell for a couple of days just to find out where you were. And I said, she threatened Larry and Carolyn that if they told me where you were, that they would never speak to you again. And he was upset about that. He wasn't happy that she was doing that. And come to find out, and actually the nurse, her name is Stacy, I talked to her. She just looked so relieved to see us. And she said, can I speak to you for a moment? And I said, yes. And she goes, your mother was just up here. And I said, oh, yeah, you had the pleasure of meeting her. And she's just like, it wasn't pleasure. She goes, I had to call the hospital security and have her removed. I had to have her escorted out of the room and out of the hospital. And I said, what happened? Because nothing shocks me. He said, we've been trying to discharge your father, and she has not been answering the phone. We finally got a hold of her, and she came up here and immediately started screaming at your father. And she goes, I felt that she could have been an issue. I felt threatened by her, that your father was at a risk. And I called security, and she left. They walked her out, and she left. I said, of course she didn't tell us any of that. She goes, I didn't feel that he was safe to go home with her. She said it was pretty bad. And I said, well, my mother is, I gave her the whole spiel. She's mentally ill. She's angry. She hates my father. She hates me. She probably, come to find out my father was having stomach pain. That's all. Stomach ache. And this is normal with chemotherapy treatment and stuff. And his bowels, he was having pain in his bowels area. And she dropped him off at the hospital. And I guess she was thinking that, oh, well, this is it. He's dying, whatever. But they wanted to discharge him, and that was on Thursday. And I stayed there pretty late with John. Me and John stayed there, and they were saying, hey, we're going to let her cool off, try it again. And they tried again on Friday to discharge him Friday morning. Well, she wouldn't answer the phone. And wouldn't answer the phone all day. And she has a cell phone herself and a house phone, wouldn't answer the phone. And I got a call, I would say, between 9 and 11 from Stacy. You know, I had met, you know, me and Stacy, we got along pretty well. Me and John both explained about my mother. The system that hospitals use is called Epic. I'm familiar with Epic because I've worked for a hospital before. And I had Stacy put in there in a note, because you can note the patient's chart electronically. I said, my mother has mental issues. She's on a lot of pain medications. She's abusive. We think that she's not properly caring for my father, withholding food from him, and not getting him to doctor appointments. Not letting him know about appointments on purpose. And she took all that information down. She put it in the chart. Well, and I gave her my number. I said, here, this is my number. Please, if anything is to change, please call me. I talked to my father on Friday morning. He was fine. Good mood. He said, hey, I'm going home today. We're trying to get a hold of your mom. Not answering. And then a little bit later, Stacy calls me. Lisa, we got to get your father into surgery. He has signed off on the surgery. I have that paper myself, actually. She goes, we need your consent. Do you give consent? It's emergency surgery. We need to get him in there. I give consent, because you tend to think that the hospitals and them, they're telling the truth. And I thought my father is in danger. They said he had signed off on it, but they need another family member's permission. And I said, yes, I will allow, yes, please take him into surgery. Went to surgery. Everything was fine. And all that was found, this is what I was told, because we went up there Friday night, you know, right after work, of course, And John and I both met each other up there because we work at different places and, you know, drive our own cars. But we both met up at Mercy Hospital. My dad's, you know, he's doped up. He's, you know, he had surgery. He had a, you know, incision in his belly area. And they said he had bowel obstruction. They cleared that. They were aware that my father had esophageal cancer. They did find a benign lesion on his liver. And as you know, benign, non-cancerous.
Non-cancer, okay? Right.
Yes, non-cancerous. That's the only thing. And, you know, Dr. Funch had even noted in the records that that's the surgeon. He noted in the records, you know, enjoyed talking to Mr. Papania. He signed off on the surgery, you know. He repeated everything back to me. He does suffer from some mild memory loss, but other than that, he was able to reiterate everything we spoke about. He signed for his surgery. Surgery was a success. There was a benign lesion. Not too concerned about that, but hopefully he can go to after this, you know, here for a couple days, go to a rehab, put on some weight, and get healthier so he could resume his treatment for esophageal cancer. And that's just the beginning of it all, because for the next couple weeks, and the surgery was on June 12th, and for the next couple weeks, I was spending the night there at the hospital. John and I were taking turns going up there every day. I would go at one, either morning or afternoon or night, and he'd go the other times. I usually would spend the night there in the couch in the room, and they couldn't get a hold of my mother, and that was nothing new.
Again. Mm-hmm.
Again. And actually, the nurses got social services involved at this point, and that's the social workers there at the hospital. And I was telling all of them, I mean, I had so many conversations with the head nurse there, the nurses there, you know, my mother's abusive. They noted it in the chart. These nurses were very nice. They were compassionate. They didn't like the fact that she wasn't answering their calls. They were trying to get him discharged from the hospital. And it's noted in the social services notes that they had called multiple times. She wouldn't answer the phone. Finally got to the point where they suspected abuse themselves, and that they, one of the social workers, she talked to risk management. Risk management for the hospital is the lawyers. That's what they call them, risk management. And the hospital lawyers there said that, okay, well, the daughter, and they told her that the daughter wanted to be able to have her father discharged and she'd take him home. Okay? She wanted him to be left in her care. And that's what made them call risk management. And they also had a referral in for possible abuse. They contacted APS themselves and documented it in their notes. The nurse, though, the social worker called me, and this is on the 17th, and she kind of had an attitude, and she said, I've been calling your mother, no answer. Your mother's got till 2 o'clock that day, and if she doesn't call me by 2, I'm going to, then you can, the risk management said that we can discharge your father to you. And I thought, well, this is going to be a no-brainer, and I'm going to be able to, you know, be able to discharge him. And 2 o'clock came, gave it a little bit after. I called her and I said, what's going on? Did she call? And they said, no. I said, okay, so I'll be up after I get off work. My father will be discharged to me in my care. She said, no, we can't do that. I said, why? I said, you told me risk management said that you could discharge him to me. That was the deal. If she didn't call you by 2, you yourself called me and told me she had till 2. I said, if she didn't call by 2 and you left her that message, he can go home with me. I can take him home. No, Dr. Kasav said to not discharge him at this time. I was just, you know.
Dumbfounded.
Yeah. Because how
right.
is it that a woman's being investigated for possible abuse? They called APS on her. They talked to the hospital lawyers. The hospital lawyers say that if she doesn't call by 2, you can discharge the patient to the daughter. And then now the doctor, he says, no, we're not going to, no, don't discharge him. So I was just dumbfounded. And then what I didn't know is that my mother called up there and scheduled and saw Dr. Kasav. My father was not involved in that meeting, nor did I even know that there had been a meeting. And my mother and my son, her grandson, had a meeting with Dr. Kasav, and my mother wanted my father put into hospice and changed to a DNR. The woman that had dropped this man off at the hospital, left him there to fend for himself at the ER, could not be found, was escorted out of the hospital the night before a surgery. There was no surgery on the schedule. They were trying to discharge him that morning, but then all of a sudden, just a couple hours later, they decided after wanting to discharge him that he needed to have emergency surgery. So I question that surgery, Marcia, to be honest with you. I don't even know if that surgery was really necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that it was, but I'll never know.
No. And at this time, she's telling everybody he has cancer, right? It's a benign tumor.
It's a benign lesion.
And she tells everybody he has cancer.
She's telling her family and everyone that my father is filled with cancer everywhere when they had surgery. Mind you, she never even called after he had surgery. She didn't. I mean, they called that morning to get her to answer, to discharge him, and then they called her saying, hey, we're rushing your husband into surgery. She never responded, didn't call to check on him after the surgery, didn't stop up there, nothing.
That's not surprising because she took him to the hospital, dropped him off at the emergency, and went back home. Who
exactly?
What wife does that? I mean, what?
A loved one.
Your spouse goes in,
then,
you want to go in with him so
know.
You can... Yeah.
It's kind of like there was a plan all along. I mean, she just wanted to be done with him. And it sounds so bizarre, and it sounds like it's not believable, but you know what, then, Marcia, I have to say, for the longest time after everything was over and done with, I questioned my sanity. Like, did this really even happen? Am I wrong?
Right.
Maybe he was sick, all of that. But then I've met so many people, and this is a common thing. After everything has happened, you are totally running on no sleep. You are not eating. I lost weight during all of this myself. We were literally, I was still going to work. My ex was going to work. We were just running on pure adrenaline. And
right, you're
a
just,
person,
I mean, you're exhausted.
Right, and
point.
you don't know what, you just don't even think about death or a hospice or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she went behind my back, the daughter, and the hospital knew who I was. I was up there every day. I was spending the night sometime. They knew who John was. And a woman who went AWOL, and they put in their notes that she was being investigated for possible abuse, and they called APS, and they contacted their own risk management. One doctor, the same doctor that declared him incompetent, was able to just say, no, don't release him to the daughter. And they knew that he was having a meeting with her, but they didn't tell me. They couldn't tell me. But June 18th, she met with him, stated she wanted him as a DNR and put him in hospice. And
for anybody, we just assume that everybody knows this, Lisa, but a DNR is do not resuscitate. So she was going to send him to a facility that said, if anything goes wrong, don't bring him back to life. Don't resuscitate. And it also means you don't do any care whatsoever. You're going to do nothing because she enrolled him in hospice, and the intent is to take him there and him to die. He's thinking he's going to get rehabilitation, to put on some weight, get stronger, and
physical
go
therapy.
Home. That is what he was told at the hospital. But your mom has gone behind and talked to the doctor and has totally different plans for him. It's unconscionable.
And the doctor was, exactly. I mean, and here's what gets me. And it just everything, you know, you learn these things afterwards. And you learn more and more about the whole grisly sick, everything about it. But she knew what she was doing. By having him, by finally finding a doctor, Dr. Kassav, to declare him incompetent, she could overrule my father's wishes, have him put in that nursing home as a DNR. And
him have no clue what was going
on.
But just a day earlier, he's repeating back to the doctor about the surgery that he's going to have, and he's consenting to that because she's not there involved with
that.
It's so tragic, absolutely. It just is. They're getting ready to put him over in the rehab facility.
Correct, and actually the day before he went in there, I was up there at the hospital to see him. He's sitting up in bed, just laughing and joking. His work buddies came up there, and they were telling jokes, and my father's such a likable guy. Everybody loved Pap. That was his nickname, Pap. Everybody loved Pap. And a couple guys were up there. They were telling jokes. My mother's sister, my Aunt Joanne, and my cousin Gina were there. And they were up there under the impression that my father's filled with cancer and that he's going into hospice. Of course, they don't mention this to my father because, you know, they're not going to tell him, hey, we know you're going to go to a nursing home to be killed, Bill. Everybody's up there. My father's sitting in his bed. He's the center of attention. Him and his friends are joking. Everything's going great. Him and I, you're going to this nursing rehab. You're going to do physical therapy. I even have a voicemail that I have posted on the Facebook page where she states, putting him at a nursing home, it's just for rehab. He's not staying, and she knows how I felt about all this. He's not staying there permanently, so this is what hospitals do. And I just assumed, okay, yes, because how many times have you been in the hospital and had surgery,
right,
Carol, and gone there and then go to rehab? And she herself had been at Oak Hills Nursing and Rehab. So she's putting him in the nursing home that she herself had gone to for rehab herself. But it was also the same place where Tiny physically walked my father out of there because Carol screamed when he brought her a hot fudge cake loves his wife and thought, I'm going to bring her a hot fudge cake, you know, because she loves hot fudge cakes from Frisch's. Went up there and she just screamed and had him kicked out by Tiny. And Tiny manhandled him, and Tiny says, and mind you, this is a man that's going through chemo treatment himself for cancer. So she was manhandling my father, escorted him out of the room, out of the building, out of the nursing home. And she, you know, she plays their victim story, but he was going to the same facility that she was at and had no idea. John and I just, you know, we had no idea that this, I mean, I found out from a nurse that she enrolled him into hospice, but, you know, at this point I'm thinking, okay, we'll get him out of that nursing home. He's not going into hospice. He's never going to agree to hospice. We had no clue that she already had gone through it all. In fact, she met with a local hospice group called Hospice of Cincinnati. Literally, Marsha, I kid you not, they're 5 minutes away from Oak Hills Nursing and Rehab, 5 minutes away. Her and my son met with a hospice person. I have the records. And my father was not a candidate for hospice. And my mother must have gone to the nursing director and said, hey, Hospice of Cincinnati saying no. So Jennifer Ball and Amanda Mastrosario of Oak Hills Nursing and Rehab, the director of nursing and the social service director, said, we'll handle it. And they went with a hospice group called Optum Hospice, which is, I kid you not, about, they're in Blue Ash. So I'd say they're anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes away from this nursing home. They, though, on the other hand, did not say my father wasn't a candidate for hospice. They signed my father up for hospice. And I knew nothing about this place. And when I called Hospice of Cincinnati, which had turned her down, the woman acted very shocked. And she said, who is she using? And I said, Optum Hospice. And she just got real quiet. I said, what's going on? She goes, Google Optum Hospice. And I said, Google Optum Hospice. And she goes, yes, Google Optum Hospice. I Googled Optum Hospice. Come to find out, Optum Hospice was found in 2014. Two nurses had turned them in as whistleblowers because Optum was forcing them, was making them put patients who were not terminal into hospice. Two nurses who actually had a conscience went and under, I always say it wrong, but they went and found a lawyer who practices the Qui Tam Act, and they proceeded to tell the lawyer everything that was going on, that they were being forced to follow have a quota, a monthly quota of patients to put into hospice each month, and they were being forced to put people in that were not qualified for hospice.
Right, that's one of the things that Michelle Duers had written about in her book, Killing for Profit, and they do have a quota to put people in.
Unbelievable,
so,
isn't it?
For, in the interest of time, I want to move forward. So
sure.
On June the 24th, he goes into the facility, and tell me what happens, the chair that he was in, and what happens that night.
They actually let him in the private room that he was allowed to be in, that he, Medicare was paying for, and what happened is he must have been doped up so badly the first day he was there and drugged so badly that he fell face forward out of the wheelchair onto his nose, and it took – and I don't know if you know it, but nursing homes go to anything goes in nursing homes in the evening, especially. There's one nurse for each floor. There's two floors, so total two nurses. And the woman across the hall found my father in a pool of his own blood, face
it's
forward on the ground. Yes.
A patient.
She was a resident there herself.
Right.
And she went to get help to get my father, to get him out of the blood and to get him help. And nobody told me, of course, and when John and I went there the next day, right after work, my father's sitting there holding his head, and he's sitting in the wheelchair. I said, Dad, what are you doing? Why don't you get up and walk around? And I don't know, Lisa, they won't let me get out of this chair, but my head hurts, and he's holding his head. I said, well, what happened? I don't know. He had a cut on his nose. And he kept holding his head, acting funny about it, like he had a headache. So I went to one of the nurses and said, hey, my father's got a headache. He's got a cut on his nose. What's going on? He's got some bruising around his forehead. Per the POA, we don't have to tell you anything. I said, that's my father. What's going on? Can he have an aspirin, something? His head hurts? Per the POA, we don't have to tell you a thing. So the woman from across the hallway actually said, she always acted very scared, and she waits till they left, and we were in the waiting area, and she goes, your father, and she told me what happened, and she said, please don't tell that I told you this, and she, you know, eyes are shifting back and forth, please don't tell, but I found your father, I went and hit, get him help, he fell on his face, and nobody, you know, the, nursing home protocol is anytime a patient falls and hits their head, they are to be taken by transport to a hospital and have an MRI. That is a rule. And Katie, the night my father, my mother, but my mother said she wasn't paying for an ambulance, don't take him to get an MRI. So Katie and my mother just didn't follow protocol and didn't get him to get an MRI.
Now, let me go back, as I explained this when you were silent earlier tonight, when we couldn't hear you. But this is the same facility that Lisa's mom went to and was there for 3 weeks. And once she put her husband in there, Bill in there, there is, several conversations will show that there was a kind of a personal relationship that Carol knew these nurses that were there. They, spoke on several different occasions. So that's kind of one of the things that you point out a little bit later. So a friend of yours who works for a camera company sent him an edible arrangement that he never wound up getting.
Correct.
But that caused some conflict because they believed that apparently if you have someone who calls from a phone number that is from a camera company, you must have been slipping a secret camera in an edible food arrangement.
I had my friend and I, she works for the camera shop. She worked for a company called the Camera Shop in Kentucky. And with my father having esophageal cancer, Kelly knew about this. She thought, I'm going to get him an edible arrangement. Fruit, will go down easy. So she called up there for the address and the room number for my father. And while she's in a conference room with her peers at her job, they had a call patched through, and the nursing director, Jennifer, called her, and she had her on speakerphone, and she said, and she goes, she wanted to talk to Kelly, why did you call here for the address? And Kelly's like, I called there because I want to send Mr. Papania an edible arrangement. And just proceeded to talk very vulgar to Kelly, and it was so astonishing because, like I said, they were in a conference meeting, and her peers, and everybody was like, oh, my God, this is a nursing director acting like this? And more or less, Jennifer Ball was accusing Kelly, why is somebody from the camera? And I have a written statement from Kelly. Jennifer said, why is somebody from the camera shop calling here for his address? Why do you want to send him something? They even noted in the medical records that they suspected a camera was hidden in the edible arrangement. They put that in their own records. And they also lied and said that I had gone around telling the staff that I was going to have a camera. I was going to have a hidden camera put in my father's room. And Kelly, all this happened with Kelly on July 1st. I had talked to Kelly because Kelly contacted me and told me what happened. Didn't really put two and two together what was all going on. But after work, John and I were up. John had already been up there in my dad's room, and my dad's sitting in the bed. We're talking to him. And John and I are both in there. It's about quarter to between 8 and 9 p.m. And one of the nurse on the floor, Katie, pops her head and she goes, excuse me, Lisa? And I said, yeah. She goes, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. You've been banned. I said, I've been banned for what? What have I done? I'm not at liberty to tell you, but you've been banned. You're not allowed to see your father. You need to leave the premises now. I said, I'm not leaving the premises. And she, in the meantime, went and called 911, and Shivia police were there with, because they're real close to the police station, just a matter of minutes. Cheviot Police Sergeant Emmett Stone and I forget the other officer's name, but they both came in and escorted me and John out of the building, and Katie locked the door behind us. And I'm asking Katie, well, while the cops walked me out, Katie, what am I being escorted? Why am I banned? And she just sat there with a smirk on her face, like, ha ha. Gotcha. And I'm asking the cop, I've always had a great relationship with cops, but I got to tell you, Marcia, Shivia Police are one of Cincinnati's worst cop districts in all of Cincinnati. When we got outside, John and I are both saying, why am I being kicked out? Why am I being banned? What's going on? Sergeant Emmett Stone of Shivia Police, who's now the police chief, he puts his hand on his gun, pulls it out just a little bit. He goes, let me tell you something. if you don't leave now, I'm going to arrest you and take you to the Justice Center and have you booked. And I said, but what did I do? Why am I being banned? I had no clue. And it was because of the edible arrangement.
And they thought you had a camera in it.
They thought there was a camera. And my father didn't even get that edible arrangement.
No, because they ate it.
Of course.
I guess
they were looking for the camera,
so they had to eat it. You had to contact an ombudsman, and eventually you were able to come back in, but not until July the 8th. So from the 1st
Correct.
To the 7th, you don't get to see them. And your dad had nothing to do with you being banned and told the ombudsman that. So on July the 3rd, I'm moving through because, Lisa, we're short on time. Okay, so July the 3rd, John calls you and tells you that your dad is having convulsions.
In the wheelchair at a nurse's station. I'm like, why is he at a nurse's station? Why? And he said, your dad's now permanently at the nurse's station. He's not allowed in his room. I said, his room? Because, you know, he was allowed in the room before I was banned. So he said, yeah, your father's no longer allowed in his room. He's at this nurse's station. Lisa, he's rocking back and forth, and he's having convulsions. It's bad. He goes, I've asked them for help. They ignore me. They said, per the POA, they don't have to do anything I say. They don't even have to talk to me, per the POA. That's what my mother has referred to, the POA. And he goes, Lisa, it's bad. It's real bad. So I called up there. They wouldn't speak to me because I was banned. And I called Cheviot Police. I spoke to Police Chief Joe Laley, and I was near tears because I'm hearing my father's rocking back and forth, having convulsions, and nobody will help him, and he's isolated at a nurse's station in a wheelchair. And Joe Laley told me that he wasn't going to get help for him. And I said, well, I'm going to call 911. He said, well, let me tell you something, Lisa. If you call 911, I'm going to intercept the call, stop the call, and then I'm going to come to your job, and I'm going to come there and personally arrest you. I said, for what? And he said, as I said, call 911. I will have the call intercepted, and I'll arrest you. And I said, I'm going to call attorney, and Mike DeWine was attorney general at that time. So I'm going to call Mike DeWine. I'm going to attorney general. He started laughing and said, go ahead. Mike DeWine's a good friend of mine, and hung up on me.
You're right. It just sounds so unbelievable that everything, they were not going to help you save your dad at all. So your dad is visiting with two of his friends, and your mom comes by, and
I was allowed back in July 8th, though, correct?
Yeah, you're back in July 8th. So, of course,
I'm back in to see my father. They tried to lie to the ombudsman, Marvin Wilson. Marvin Wilson, me and him talked many times. He said
that. Lisa, you got a few days to get through, and we've got 15 minutes.
Yeah. I got back in. I'm visiting my father again. Where were you at this point?
Okay, so he tells your mom that, you know, come in here. You're going to take me home. I'm going to get out of here today.
Exactly.
And he
says
that in front of two
there.
Of his friends. Yes.
Correct, because they would come up there daily to visit. You're not leaving. He's up there playing cards with his friends, and he saw my mom at the nurse's station whispering with the nurses, and he said, Carol. And she came over. He said, Carol, you're taking me home today. I'm leaving here today. You are taking me home. And she leaned over, looked him in his eye, kind of snarled. That's how she talks when she wants to scare you. And she goes, you're not leaving here, Bill. You're dying here. And then she walked away. And my father, being the gentleman he is, apologized to James and John Lane and James Martino for my mother's behavior. His common thing, did what he always does. I'm sorry for how she acted. He was more embarrassed how she acted.
Well, sure. So one of the is this the time where the nurse says to her to knock it off?
To who?
To your mom, and told her to be quiet. Is that when she told your mom to be quiet?
No, my son told her to be quiet on July, if we go forward to August 3rd, August 3rd, they had shaved everything on him, his hair. They cut his hair really short. They shaved his beard. They had him doped up on Haldol. They even shaved his arms. And then this was done on August 3rd. We have a picture of that. August 4th, one of the nurses calls me and says that, and she called me from my mother's cell phone, which I found very weird. She said, it was Ashley Marthaler. She said, Lisa, your father's dying. We just thought we should tell you in case you wanted to come up. I immediately got off the phone with her, called John. We raced up there, and I called my friend Nikki on the way. She went up there with us. Me, Nikki, and John are in there. My son is in there, and Carol's in there, and my father doesn't die. He wasn't dying. They didn't drug him enough to kill him, is what happened.
That particular day.
Yikes. So that was August 4th. The next day, John and I are up there with my father. My mother and my son are in the room, and my mother and I proceed to have an argument. She's saying it's time for my father to die. She starts talking about how my dad's there, but he's doped up on Haldol, non-responsive, just sitting there like in a daze. She's telling us that she's talking out loud. She's going in front of my father, because he could hear everything, she's going to have him cremated, okay, as if he's already dead. That's when my son told her, knock it off, not now. You're not going to talk like that now. This can be talked about later. I mean, my son more or less put her in her place because she was having one of her moments. And she told me she had already...
They say the last thing to go is hearing. So your dad could probably hear her saying that but not react. So,
Marcia,
he
heard everything.
He did.
She tried to hold his hand, and I was holding his hand, and my friend Nikki was holding his hand the night before, and we were saying prayers and everything because we thought my dad was dying. That's what we were told. My mom went to hold his hand, and he grabbed his hand away from her.
So he knew. He knew.
Yeah. You can hear everything.
On July the 27th, you received a call from the same lady across the resident across the hall who said your dad was laying in a wheelchair and he wasn't breathing, and she asked you not to tell anybody. At that time, you called 911, but you gave a false name because your dad had said, anytime you do something, it affects me, and then they're mean to me, so don't do anything, don't cause any waves. So you called 911, gave a false name, and said, somebody needs to get down there to check on a patient. Okay? I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yes, I said he was in his wheelchair.
Correct. Yes. So on August the 8th, they had given him morphine, Ativan, and Haldol, and they took his oxygen away from him. And when you came in, you saw that he was gasping for air, and the nurse wasn't doing anything. So you demanded she give him back the oxygen. But later that day when you were there, and later that day she came back in, took his oxygen away, and said, I'm taking it away. The POA says I can, and I don't have to tell you anything.
And she said she does hospice on the side. And she had the heat on in the room, real hot. When I came into the room, she was taking his pulse while he was gasping for air. And I said, where is his oxygen? She says, I do hospice on the side. She had, how each little room has its own little air conditioner. She had the heat on, full blast. This is in the summer. Full blast.
Miserable.
And she had just given him morphine and didn't have to talk to me. I went and called the hospice group, Optum. I spoke to a girl, a nurse by the name of Leah, and I said, Katie just took his oxygen tank away. She gave him some kind of drug. He's sitting here panting. I have the video on my website of my father gasping for air. Leah says, okay, I'll call her. So Leah must have called Katie, told her, I told Katie, go get the oxygen tank. Leah must have called her. They must have had a conversation outside of the room. Katie came back stomping in and brought back the oxygen tank, but she had it on the lowest setting. I turned it back up. My father, it took a while for him to calm down, to stop gasping for air, and he had his oxygen tank back. But
it's just so cool.
We knew
I mean, it is so cool.
It's inhumane.
That they did this.
Inhumane.
It's inhumane. So on the day that they actually murdered him, August the 13th, 2015, they actually made all of you leave the room.
Three times.
While they injected
two nurses.
Him. Two nurses. They injected him.
Nurse aide.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They injected him with lethal dose, came out in the hall and said, he's gone.
Patient died.
And they
made us.
And nobody would let you be with him. I just find that.
According to the records, though, he died with everybody. You know what, though? According to my mother couldn't be found, and my dad's cousin, his two cousins, his cousin's wife, myself, my friend, Nikki, John, and my brother, who conveniently was flown in the night before from my mother. He flew in on August 12th. On August 13th, my father's dying. My uncle is the one who found out my father was dying from my aunt, and my dad's cousins told him. So my uncle called me and said, get up there quick. You and John, they said, your father's dying. We run up there. They said his fingers were molting and his, you know, the nail beds are changing colors and his skin was molting. No, I checked everything. His fingers weren't changing colors. His skin wasn't molting. My dad's cousins were there. We were all there. My brother was there, but he was keeping an eye on me. And he
but
and
this
I
is
don't
when they
speak.
Asked every, they made all of you leave the room.
Three times. The two nurses.
Three times. Okay. So
and they shut the
day,
door behind them and would be in there alone with my father.
And he had to die alone with no one with him.
He was murdered by them because they came out with a needle still.
Right.
The second time they came out of the room, Heather had the needle in her hand still that she had just used. I looked over at my friend, because we're out in the hallway, right? I said, Nikki,
okay.
look at her hand. And there's a needle in her hand. She's her. Yeah. Is it almost
okay,
over? I'm sorry.
We have 3 minutes. Let me skip through this real quick.
Okay.
So the day after, Lisa is served a letter that says she
correct.
Has to take everything off of social media by the 18th or they're going to sue her. And on that day, on the 18th, the day before her father was laid to rest after being murdered, two officers show up ringing her doorbell. Lisa hides inside. They came back that evening, 8 o'clock, happened to see Lisa upstairs, and they said, come down here. We're giving you a warrant, and if you don't come down here, we're going to show up at the funeral and give you this warrant. What they gave her a warrant for that she was arrested for and had to go to court for is because on July the 27th, on July the 27th, when she made that phone call, that emergency phone call, 911, and gave a fictitious name so that someone would go check on her dad, they filed charges against her because she gave a fictitious name. She had to go to court. She had to hire an attorney and go to court. They dismissed the charges on that. The judge even said, if I was in this situation, I would want my daughter to advocate for me as you did for your father. So not only was her dad murdered with assistance from apparently her mother, not only did the police absolutely do nothing to help her, and not only did they murder her dad, but afterwards, they come after her. Now, Lisa has a sign in her yard about the hospice facility, the rehab facility where he died. She has been threatened before by attorneys and by the police themselves. If she doesn't take that down, that they're going to come after her, they're going to sue her. All of these things have happened to her after she lost her dad. Almost 5 years ago, and Lisa still fights that battle trying to get some justice. Will she get that? Will any of us get that justice? That's why we do the show, to let you know that these things are happening. They are real cases. They're not made up. This happened to her. Lisa, I think we're over our time, but we have 52 seconds, so I'll give the last minute to you.
Okay. It's just the cops were there to protect the nursing home and their staff and not the victims. I was arrested August 18th for a call that I made on July 27th. I begged. I've contacted the Attorney General. They couldn't help me. The Inspector General couldn't help me. All agencies in place are not there for you. They will not investigate. Nursing homes are the devil's playground. And once your loved one's in there, you're not. I was told by Ron, what's his name? The guy.
Panther.
Hospital.
Ron Panther.
Yeah, Ron Panther. Spoke to him, a very nice guy, but he's brutally honest. Once your loved one's in the system, you're not going to rescue them, but it's your obligation to make people aware of what's happening.
It is. Because they don't know. There are so many people that have absolutely no clue what's going on. So that's why we talk about it. It's painful for all of us who've been through it, but we continue the battle to fight for justice. Lisa has a site called Justice for My Dad. Thank you, Lisa, for coming on and telling your story.
I also want to say one last thing. People, be informed. Go to Hospice Alliance, and Ron Panther knows everything. Everything he says is true. Be informed.
That's true. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lisa. Good night, everyone. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Lisa. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Good night.
Through Project Up, Comcast is helping to build a future of unlimited possibilities. From connecting people to the internet to opening doors for the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, and storytellers, our goal is to create a future that benefits generations to come. That's why we're committing $1 billion to reach tens of millions of people with the skills, resources, and opportunities they need to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
As an artist of faith, my creativity and spirituality are integral to my identity.
But I'm caught between two worlds.
Luckily, I found Be Make Do, and I'm ready to be who I was created to be.
Be Make Do, the podcast. Listen at soulmakers.org/bemakedo.